Okay, good afternoon. So last time we started talking about assembly, including things that are different from 2115. So we talked about what AT&T syntax looked like. And we looked into converting C to assembly. Gave you this general strategy that since C supports GoTo, and GoTo is similar to what happens in assembly, a good first step is to convert whatever C code you have first to use GoTo, and then convert that to assembly. And speaking of conditions, which have happened in our C code, talked about condition codes, which is how on x86 conditional jumps work. So we have talked about arithmetic instructions and comp and test, these dedicated instructions. Do some arithmetic, look at the result of that, and set condition codes, and they are then used by conditional jumps and some other instructions, which are named based on what happens with subtraction. So if the result is zero, that's equal. If the result is positive, that's greater. If the result is negative, that's less than, because that's what happens when you do a subtraction based on how the values differ. We'll have more detail on that today. So before we get into new material, I'd like to talk about the quiz, since most people got this question wrong. So what happens here is the first instruction copies the stack pointer, whatever that is, into REX. So REX contains the address of the top of the stack. Then we push that value onto the stack. And this modifies memory, but that doesn't matter because nothing in this assembly snippet reads memory. But it also changes where the stack pointer points. In particular, it moves it down by 8 bytes because we have to make room for that thing we're pushing. Then we subtract that move stack pointer from the original stack pointer, and that's going to give us 8 because that's how much we move the stack pointer by. Then this LEA, remember LEA doesn't actually access memory, it just computes a memory address, and that's it. So it computes this memory address using our standard formula of taking our 8 plus 8 times 2, which is 24, and then it's done. It has that address, and it stores that address back in RAX. So any questions on what was happening in this assembly snippet? Okay, so, and a note is that on quizzes, you know, you have a computer, I don't mind if you like run code. That was, it would have been a valid way to start help to figure out the answer to the quiz question. Note that it didn't completely solve it because one of the options was it depends on where the stack pointer is and what's on the stack. So you had to know enough about what was going on to know that that didn't matter. But on a quiz, that's a fine thing to do. If that's what you need to do to understand what's going on, go ahead. Obviously, if we ask a question like this in a test, which could happen, that won't work. So you won't have a machine in front of you. Okay. And so any other questions about the quiz? Okay. So also a note on upcoming labs. So this week's lab tomorrow is going to be dealing with some pointer heavy code in C. And we're going to have a tool that you're going to use called Address Sanitizer, which is part of GCC and Clang, which will help you find malloc and free related mistakes in code. And will give you something that is hopefully better at diagnosing the error than a segmentation fault. Not that that would be hard. And your task is going to be to take a broken circular doubly linked list implementation, so a variant of a doubly linked list, that I've chosen partly so you won't just look up what a doubly linked list implementation looks like and compare the code. So it's going to be broken, it's going to have a bunch of sort of malloc and free related errors, and your job is going to be to fix it, and at least fix it enough that our tool says nothing's wrong when you run the test program, this error tool. So it's not enough for it just to not crash, we also want it to not crash when you use this tool which is designed to find these errors. So you're done when the report's no errors. We will give full credit for something less than fixing all the bugs, but we're not going to tell you how much because we don't want people just running out of the lab early, but it should be lenient enough that if you spend the 75 minutes, you should get full credit of the lab time. And there's no homework after this lab. And the reason for that is next week's lab. So next week's lab is an in-lab quiz on, again, writing pointer code in C. And what we're going to have you do is have you write a version of the library function stringlen and a slightly simplified version of stringsep. This is in the lab write-up. We'll be in the lab write-up, and we will have a coding environment that you'll write it in lab. You will not have access to notes, websites, while you're doing this. Teachers will be watching to make sure. But you'll have to code up those exact functions during the lab time. We have implementations of them in the lab write-up, and if you want to memorize them to do it, that is fine with us. This is not the most reliable strategy. It is more reliable to know enough about what's going on, so if you type it up wrong, you can figure out what's wrong. Yes? How would I suggest preparing? So we will give you early access to the actual environment you will use in lab. So my recommendation is just actually practice in as close to those conditions as possible. Okay. Any questions about next 2 weeks' labs? Okay, so let's move on to continue our material from last time. So last time we were talking about condition codes, and I mentioned we had these operators based on results of subtraction, and so I sort of said that we somehow store something about the last sort of arithmetic operation. And today I'm going to go into more detail about what that something we're storing looks like. Now, an x86 has made a particular choice about exactly what information they store. And that is to store these condition codes. There's one other we won't talk about in this class. And these are how it represents the information that those conditional jump operators need. So after every arithmetic operation, like a subtraction, in addition to setting the result, if we do, we also set all these condition codes based on what happened during the computation. So the first one there is ZF, or zero flag, which is true if the result was zero and false otherwise. So this corresponds to the equal condition in the conditional jump. Second one is the sign flag. It's named the sign flag because it's a copy of the sign bit from the result. It was the result negative. So we just take the sign bit, take a wire from that, and store it somewhere else. That's how we do that. And that corresponds to less than for our conditional jump operators. Then we have these two weird ones, the carry flag and the overflow flag. So these both indicate overflow or underflow, depending on the operation. In one case, with the carry flag for if you're doing unsigned arithmetic, and with the overflow flag if you're doing signed arithmetic. So in the case of subtraction, for example, if we subtract a negative number from a positive number and get a negative number, then something, you know, that's the wrong answer. And as signed arithmetic, that would be an overflow. So that would set the overflow flag. So any case basically where we're not getting the right answer because we had some sort of wraparound happen. And we want this for comparisons because we'd like to have jump less than do the right thing even if the subtraction actually overflows because the numbers are too big. So let's go through an example here. So here's a simple comparison where we're doing the subtraction of 20 and negative 10, and we get 30. So our result is 30, and we can look at how that means each of the flags are set. So since our result is 30, no matter how we look at it, it's 30, that's not zero, no matter whether it's signed or unsigned. And that indicates to us that the two values weren't equal. We also can look set the sign flag. So the sign flag, as I said, indicates whether the values are negative. It's a copy of the sign bit. The sign bit isn't set in the results, even in the case where it should have been negative. The sign bit's still not set because we do standard 2's complement subtraction. So the sign flag is zero. So then we have the tricky ones, the carry flag and the overflow flag. And the easiest way for me to think about this, you might have other ways you prefer, is I look at if I was treating this as assigned arithmetic, doing it out by hand, is the result I get the result that's going to be in our 32 or 64 or whatever size register. And in this case, the result as signed is correct. 30 minus negative 10, we treat those both as signed numbers, so 20 minus negative 10 is positive 30, that's all right, so the result is correct, so the overflow flag should be zero. We didn't have any overflow problems on this actual calculation we did for the comparison. But the carry flag, on the other hand, if we look at what the unsigned calculation was, we had this as an unsigned number, negative 10, stored in the register as unsigned, is this giant number. So we subtracted a giant number from a small number and got a positive number, so that's wrong. So the carry flag should be set. Okay, any questions about what happened here? Okay, so given that, you should be able to figure out this example. This is 2 to the 63 slash negative 2 to the 63, and that's 2 to the 63 minus 1, just in case it's not clear when I mean exponentiation. Those are all exponentiation to represent those values. So you figure this out and compare with your neighbor, see if you actually agree on what all the values are. Okay, who thinks they figured out most of it? Who thinks they haven't figured out any? Nah, thinks they're still working? Okay, a couple people, good. Okay. Okay, so hopefully enough of you have most of the answer. So we'll start by my first step when doing this is to figure out, by doing this by hand, is to figure out what the results would be by hand as signed and unsigned. The hardware is only going to do one computation, but I find this easier to do by hand that way. And we see that as unsigned, we get, if we do the natural calculation, we get this value which doesn't fit in 64 bits, so there's overflow. And as signed, everything fits, so there's not. And we can look at that result. It's one, bit pattern for one, so it's not zero. And it's also doesn't have the signed bits yet. So the signed flag is zero. So then you can see, I already determined that as a signed computation, it overflows as an unsigned one, we got the right answer. So the overflow flag is true because we had a signed overflow, the carry flag is false. Okay, any questions on this? Yeah. How can I tell whether another number is negative by the hex value? So if you vaguely recall 2's complement from 2150, the first bit of a number in 2's complement tells you whether it's negative or not. That's what we call the sign bit. So in hex, I know that anything which is the full length of the register, which in this case is 16 characters in hex, which I wouldn't expect you to count by hand, but I assert that I wrote the right number, and starts with something 8 or greater that must have the signed bit set. Yeah, I've told you what the values were here, partly because I don't want you spending your time saying, how many Fs did you write? And counting wrong and getting the question wrong for that reason. It's not useful. And I'll try to avoid doing that on exams, for example. Okay, so I'd also note that, as you mentioned, this applies to all sorts of calculations. So if I just do an add, it also sets all these flags. And the zero flag and the sign flag are straightforward, but the overflow flags are based on the addition, since that's the operation we did. They're based on whether the addition produced the right answer. And the same is going to be true for every other sort of operation that might set these carrier overflow flags. That it's going to set it based on that particular operation. So if it's a multiplication that sets it, it's going to look at, is the result of the multiply correct, and so on. Okay. Any questions on this? Clear that we did it for compare, which does a subtraction internally. We can just do an add instruction, same things apply. Same rules, we get all the flags still set, and we can still use them if we write a conditional jump instruction after that add. For example. Yes?
Wait, so does the argmax just know as negative 1, or you add negative 2 to argmax?
Oh, I see what happened here. No, because I meant to write this. Thank you for catching that. And so we apply this to converting C to assembly. So before we finish that topic, a little exercise. Now that you should be more comfortable knowing exactly how finish codes work. So which of these are right, if any? And if you're stuck, my recommendation is to do the first step of rewriting the while loop as something with a go-to and if statements. And you can compare your answers with your neighbor and see if you agree on which of these are valid versions of that loop. Yes, and you are allowed to check with your neighbor, and you probably should, because this is a nitpicky question. Okay, who has answers for most of them? Okay, probably enough people. So who thinks A is correct? Thinks A is incorrect? Okay, so the easiest call out for A being wrong is that we call foo without doing a comparison. And if B is 10, for example, we're not supposed to ever call foo. So how about version B? Who thinks version B is right? Thinks version B is wrong? Okay, so version B is right, especially since in this lecture I corrected the conditional jump to have greater than or equal, because we're computing, this is RBX is greater than or equal to 10 is the comparison we're doing, because the order is kind of wrong in AT&T syntax. So how about version C? Who thinks version C is correct? Thinks version C is wrong? Okay, so we have about a 50-50 split. So one way to make this clearer, perhaps, is to realize that, first of all, our rule that compare is just a subtract without storing the result. And since we don't use the value of REX, this is exactly the same as if we had written comp Q here instead of sub Q. And that means we're comparing 10 on the right-hand side, which, if we look at the version B, can't be right if version B is right, because then we're doing the same comparison. So one way to fix this would be to change this to the opposite type of jump, because that's the reverse of the comparison. That subtract is doing a comparison, but it's the reverse of the comparison we're doing in B, because RAX is the second thing we wrote in our assembly, not the and that's the 10. Yeah. So the question is, could we also flip the registers in the sub? So that would make the comparison have the correct result, but it would now mean we're changing RBX. So we could do that if we like saved a copy of RBX somewhere else and restored it. Yeah. So any questions on any of these examples? Yes.
So the one finally compared to you is false, then you won't start the loop, and you'll proceed to the rest of the code. So I don't really see how it would work. It would loop 10 times, and then after those 10 times, compare.
You don't see how which one doesn't?
A.
A? Because B is not set in this code. B has to be set to some value beforehand, and it could be like 20. And if you saw that B equals 20 in that code, you'd say, what are you doing? And you'd also say, okay, that loop shouldn't run. But this is a subtlety that a lot of people miss when they look at translating while loops is that they often assume that usually you do the loop at least once, so they don't generate the code for that special case. Obviously, your compiler cannot get away with that. Very angry. So we saw that there are several ways of writing a while loop, and you can see your compiler generate various things. So for example, we can avoid doing the extra comparison, extra jump, by reorganizing the code like this, and some compilers will do that. They'll do the comparison at the top, and then they'll move the loop condition to the bottom so they avoid a jump instruction in the loop. How about this weird version of the loop here? What's the advantage of that? Why did the compiler want to do that? That is actual output from a real compiler compiling this loop. So why did the compiler decide it was a good idea to generate that piece of assembly code over the others? I'm not saying that, and the compiler is not always right, but there's a justification you can make for that third version of the assembly code. So any volunteers for why you might want to prefer that version? Yeah?
The decrement kind of acts as a compare statement, then it changes the value of RBX?
Yeah, so the decrement here, we're using decrement, taking advantage of decrement, it's arithmetic, it sets the condition codes. So the decrement is enough for the JNE to do a compare to zero. And by doing this, we got rid of one instruction from the loop. So maybe it's faster. And this compiler has code to generate that just to get rid of that instruction. And maybe it's faster. We'll learn more in this semester, which will give you a better idea of whether that's faster or not. It's complicated, but that's the sort of justification for having all this extra setup code to change the loop counter into being something that goes up to 10 to something that goes down from down to zero. Yes?
Why is R12 set to 10 at the end of the loop?
So the question is, why is R12 set to 10? Right. That probably should be RBX is being set to 10. So, given, it depends on the context, right?
Yeah.
Depends on what happens after the loop, but probably this would make more sense for this to be RBX, in which case we know that 10, B is 10 at the end of the loop and the compiler is exposing that. It could also move it to R12, but that's the reason for that. Is that the compiler still wants to have RBX be available later in some form, or B, I should say. Yes?
So I guess for clarification, the other two are incrementing and counting up, and this one does the opposite, it's kind of counting down?
Yeah, it's counting down. So the compiler did a lot of work, relatively speaking, to make it count down. And to save one instruction in the loop, if the loop is executed like 10,000 times, maybe that's worth it. If it's executed twice, probably not. And maybe not even if it's executed 10,000 times. We'll learn more later in the semester about how to gauge what the difficulties are with running this loop fast. Yeah.
Why is the third one a 9 and the first two are 10?
Why is the third one a 9 and the first two are 10? That's probably a bug in my part. That should be, I think I meant to do this. I probably, at one point, tried to make it look more similar to the others and then undid that. Okay. But the main point here is that there are multiple ways of writing this loop. And that's going to be true in general, and compilers are doing some tricks. So speaking of that, so there's one big C construct we didn't talk about, and that's switches. So the most straightforward way of taking a switch case statement like this compiling it is just to have do the same thing you do for a bunch of if-elses. So here's one version of the code. Let's say we have 100 cases. Just for example, can you do something smarter than this? Can you think of something better than this code to write? Here, where we compare A to 1, compare A to 2, and so on. Yeah. So it removes some of the case. So you say if it fails case one, you don't want to check the others.
Well, like, you can figure out a way to say that if it fails case one, it also fails X amount
of other cases. Okay, so we want to do, so here we're doing what the comparison is one equal to RAX. We could do something where we could say eliminate more cases than that. So we could say, so we could do something like a binary search. And that is, in fact, an option. So we could say if we have 100 cases, we could say let's compare to 50 and have code which does the rest of the comparisons that we jump to and split it up that way. So there's a binary search like you hopefully learned at some point in the past. So you could write that out. And sometimes compilers will generate this. Compile a switch statement. It's not just the case that it's, this is for switch statements, that it's like a single straightforward translation. And there's another option, which you may or may not have seen in the homework, which is a jump table. So we can have a lookup table where we have a list of addresses of code, and we just look up the appropriate entry in that table, which is reading it like an array. And there's this funny instruction here, this jump star table. So that's the AT&T syntax for read a value from memory, in this case, and use the value read from memory as the address of the next instruction to run. It's kind of doubly indirect that way. So this says take table, which is a label, so an address, add the value in REX to it, multiply times 8, and read the memory address there and jump there. And in our assembly code, compiler would typically generate, we have the addresses of the code for each case in that table. And we also have some code around it to make sure that we, you know, deal with things where the value is not in range of the table. This makes sense? So, and there's this funny star which we didn't talk about, which is the sort of the AT&T syntax for an indirect jump. So any questions? We're going to move on and talk about why D6. So we talked about doing, yeah, sorry.
Is the table faster than just linearly going through all?
So the question is a table faster than linearly going through? So it depends on how many things you're going through. If you have 3 cases, probably not. If you have 100, almost certainly. And compilers generally have some heuristics where they'll choose what to do based on what they guess is faster. And for example, the binary search method is often better if your table would like have to be multiple megabytes or something like that. You have like 100 cases, but they range from like 1 to 1,000,000. Okay. So in this course, we're not using x86 later on. We're going to have you implement an instruction set called y86 made up by our textbook authors. That's a simplified kind of version of x86. And one of the simplifications is that I told you all about condition codes. We're going to get rid of CF and OF. We're just not going to deal with overflow and underflow. We're just going to do the wrong thing when you have a comparison that overflows or underflows. Obviously, that would not be acceptable in a real processor, but it's going to save you a bunch of work on assignments. And since we're talking about implementing processors, I'd like to talk more generally about instruction sets and what that is. And in particular, one important concept is what's an instruction set versus what's sort of a processor design. And we'll have this term in this course, a microarchitecture. That refers to a sort of design strategy for a processor. It's the design of the hardware. So for example, Intel mentions that their chips have generations. They say you have a fifth generation Core i5. Each of those generations is a separate microarchitecture. It's a different hardware design. And different microarchitectures might have different performance, different power efficiency, etc. Even though they implement the same interface for programming. So that's the instruction set. The instruction set is what you and your OS sees when it interfaces with the processor. So there are different processors that with different hardware designs that have the same instruction set, so you can run the same software on them. Which means that the machine code is the same, and what the instructions do is the same, even if the performance might not be the same, and the power efficiency and so on. And microarchitectures for the same instruction set can be very, very different. So a notable case in this is when we have very low power processors versus like desktop or server processors. So for example, Intel used to have a line of processors they called Atom, which implemented the same instruction set as many of their desktop processors, but they had a very, very different design because they wanted it to be really low power. And the things you do to make desktops fast don't make them very low power. So they had a completely sort of different hardware design philosophy between the two groups. So we're going to talk a bit further about instruction sets, and this is just the interface of it visible to the software. So clearly there's a relationship between instruction sets and microarchitectures. But there are many implementations, many ways to implement any instruction set. But when people design instruction sets, they're thinking of helping the people writing assembly. So they're thinking of making that assembly writing convenient, making it so compilers and maybe humans can generate efficient assembly for their programs. They don't need to like do slow things like move values to memory all the time when that, you know, even though there might be the hardware capable of storing values, something like that. They're also thinking of the hardware. And this is kind of a competing concern. They want the hardware to be easy to design, to be efficient or cheap or low power, or various other concerns. And many instruction sets are designed with a particular hardware implementation in mind. But that doesn't mean that the microarchitecture we're actually using to implement it uses that. For example, x86 comes from like the 70s and 80s. The strategies we have for designing processors today are very different from what people were doing in the 70s and 80s. And they're used for x86. It makes it less convenient, but we still use these more modern strategies that x86 was clearly not designed for. Because that wasn't the implementation the people who wrote the instruction set had in mind. Another big instruction set design concern is flexibility for the future. So x86 had this long history where it was still using it even though it comes from the 80s. And this is a common thing that happens with instruction sets. Instruction sets just don't die very much. Some we don't use anymore, but the ones we use have been around for a long time. And it's actually hard to change. This seems kind of weird because it's software. It's not the hardware. The hardware is the stuff that's hard to change. But it turns out it's really hard to make people change all their software. People expect the software they compiled 5 years ago to still work. So you're kind of committed to an instruction set. So a major concern when you're designing new instruction sets, if you ever do that, is how do I plan for the future? How do I make sure I can add functionality I want and make sure I don't regret including functionality that I really won't want to implement in the future? That's a big concern, is handling these extensions. And you probably know of x86, you may have heard of ARM. There are a lot of instruction sets out there. So this is a list of just instruction sets which I know you can currently buy new chips for, new processors. And it's probably incomplete. There are a lot of instruction sets. There are also more instruction sets that aren't manufactured anymore. But there's a lot of them. So apparently people weren't happy with x86 and ARM for some reason. There are lots of reasons for that. People design these all the time. So clearly there's some sort of trade-off that they're considering, you know, where they have a different idea about what the right thing to do is than what people did before. So we're going to take a bit of time to look at different instruction set design decisions and, you know, that people make and how these instruction sets are different. And I'm going to start with three big things. So one is the machine code. How big are instructions in the machine code? Is it variable length or not? So variable length is going to make hardware implementation harder, but it's going to make programs more compact. Also means more flexibility for the future, probably. Also the number of what I call normal registers, sometimes called general purpose registers, registers you can use with basically any arithmetic operation. And this will vary a lot. So having less registers means that you can have a more compact hardware implementation. Having more registers means that it's easier to make efficient code, because you do less moving things back and forth between memory. And also just how many instructions you have. And that obviously affects how much time you have to put into building your hardware, because you need to have something implementing each of the instructions. And I have approximate number because counting instructions is very tricky. So for example, in x86, you can compare bytes, you can compare 32-bit values, 64-bit values, 16-bit values. Are those separate instructions? Depends who you ask. That's why I have approximate number, because not everyone agrees on what's a separate instruction. So any questions on things which stand out on this chart to people? Make sense? Yeah.
What's the asterisk mean?
So what do the asterisks mean? So I have an asterisk on the instruction size for some cases and on the approximate number of instructions. So for the instruction size, I mean that's the typical instruction size for ARMv7 and RISC. That's the typical instruction size, but there are exceptions. There's some notable modes where instructions have different sizes. For Itanium, it's kind of debatable whether the thing I'm calling an instruction is actually what is an instruction. And the asterisk next to the number of instructions for RISC-V, RISC-V has several versions and they have very different numbers of instructions. So there's a wide variety of choices people have made, and x86 just happens to be one of these points, ARM just happens to be one of these points. So these are sort of the biggest high-level decisions. There are also a bunch of other decisions that you've probably taken for granted are how computers work, which aren't actually. So one is condition codes. So we talked about condition codes. It's the way to do if statements and so on. This is not the only mechanism instruction sets have chosen. So in x86, in ARM, this is how they do it. In, for example, MIPS, they don't have condition codes. They don't have any of those extra special registers. Instead, they have these compare and jump instructions, like this branch if equal. So if R11 and R12 are equal, go to somewhere for that instruction sets. And there are certain advantages to doing this and disadvantages. So advantage, for example, here is that this makes some types of hardware implementation simpler because you don't have to track condition codes. A disadvantage is that, as we saw, you kind of get some comparisons for free when you do condition codes, like we saw with that loop with the decrement followed by the jump equal at the end. That kind of gave us a comparison for free. Which you don't get when you do this. Another big choice is addressing modes. So we have this weird way we can specify memory addresses in x86. So someone chose that I want you to be able to specify a base plus an index times this 1, 2, 4 rate, because that's convenient for like arrays. So they chose that that's how a way we could specify operands, and the other way was like, we could specify a register. Other instruction sets often make different choices here. So ARM, for example, lets you specify a value where you shift the bits over which is equivalent to multiplying times 2 a couple times, a specified number of times. That's an operand you can specify on many ARM instructions. You can say, I want to add R10 and R11 multiplied times 8. The R11 multiplied times 8 is an operand you can just specify. And there's a whole bunch of other choices. So VAX, which is an old instruction set we'll see a little more of, even let you specify, I want to have a value which contains a pointer to a pointer, and I'd like to access the thing that the pointer I'm pointing to points to. And that's a thing you could do in most instructions on VAX. You can say, anytime you can specify a register, you could also specify, I want to use this register as a pointer to a pointer to get the value. And these choices, and it, you know, having more addressing modes makes it easier to write this powerful assembly. It makes it harder to implement the hardware. Another big choice is the number of operands. So in x86, you see two operands. We have a source, a second source, and which is also a destination. Many instruction sets choose to do source, source, destination. So you can have a different destination register than either of your sources. So this is more flexible. So it's more convenient for compilers and people writing assembly by hand. You can avoid some moves this way. Like most of the time you have a move from one register to another in x86, it's because you don't have add or subtract or other arithmetic instructions like this. So that's more convenient in that way. But it also needs more room in the machine code. Because in the machine code, if we have three operands, we need to write three registers in there. That's going to take up more space. And that's a disadvantage. Another big choice, you know, and a more subjective one, is instruction complexity. So commonly, to keep implementing hardware simpler, a thing people want to do in instruction sets is not have any complicated instructions. And complicated means things that might be complicated to implement in hardware. So one big issue is instructions that write multiple values. For example, push or pop both write to two things in x86. This is actually exceptionally complicated. It's more complicated than a typical instruction. Just to have those instructions, we're going to have to make our hardware more complicated. For example, pop changes two registers, so now we need a way to write two registers in a single instruction. That's extra complexity for just that one relatively rare instruction. And x86 has some even more complicated things. For example, movesb is an instruction that reads a value from memory and writes it back to a different place in memory. That's right, accessing memory twice is pretty complicated. And many instruction sets either choose to do this because it's convenient for assembly programmers, or choose not to do this because they want to make implementing hardware much more straightforward. Yes?
So I think we learned in 2050 that you can't access memory twice in an instruction because the CPU can't guarantee that it will
work. Okay, so your question is, we learned in 2150 you can't access memory twice in one instruction. So for almost all x86 instructions, this is true. There are some special instructions which you mostly will not use that access memory twice. But for most instructions, for example, you can't write an add that accesses memory twice. That's not allowed.
But the reason that you can't have two memory accesses in one instruction is that the CPU can't do that twice in one cycle, then why is...
So the question is, but you learn that the CPU can't do that twice in one cycle. So yes, this is true, mostly. But it turns out that not all instructions will be executed in one cycle. And this will depend a lot on the microarchitecture, right? Because that's a statement about microarchitecture. So what the instruction set provides could be implemented in ways which are more complicated than doing things in one cycle. And that's usually what's going to happen for that. But x86 doesn't actually disallow for these special instructions like movesb. But it does disallow it for add. Just partly because of the complexity issue and probably partly because they didn't want to make an encoding for that in the x86 machine code, because it's not very useful. But with these complicated instructions, we're going to talk about sort of a big overarching debate in sort of computer architecture, which is RISC versus CISC. talk with RISC. So RISC stands for Reduced Instruction Set Computer. And you might say, reduced from what? What are we reducing? And it's reduced from something called a complex instruction set computer. And our book like has a little sidebar which goes into what the authors think are typical characteristics of RISC and SIS, and they kind of mention that, you know, sometime in like the 70s, 80s, people were coming up with this idea of simpler processor instruction set designs. I think the best way to understand sort of this RISC idea of why reduced, why do we want to reduce our instruction set, is to look at the big thing that was the classic example of an instruction set at the time RISC was being made, which is VAX. And VAX is really, you know, a CISC instruction set. It really is complex. And to give you an illustration of that, you've seen earlier that, like in some previous slides, I mentioned VAX does both two and three operands. But VAX does some really complicated instructions. So I like told you push and pop were kind of complicated. These are some real VAX instructions. I'll just let you read these descriptions. So these instructions are very complicated. Like these are like reasonable exercises to give you in 2150 for like C programming. I'm gonna say, they implemented these in hardware? That seems really hard. You know, kind of. So I'm gonna say, you know, for say match C, which is find a string in another string, You need a loop. You don't know how big the string is. So you have a loop in hardware? Well, kind of. So the most common implementation strategy at the time that RISC was coming about was something called microcode. So there was a table inside the machine which converted this instruction to a sequence of instructions for some secret simpler instruction set that they looked up in a table, these simpler instruction set called micro instructions or microcode. And that's what the machine actually executed. And that's how the machine was implemented to have support these really complex instructions. And at the time VAX was being designed, it was very common for people to write assembly by hand. People didn't really trust compilers. They were very new. They often produced very bad assembly code. So they were really aiming to cater to people who are writing assembly by hand. And that's why they had these complicated instructions. Because this instruction, you know, you wouldn't want to implement it in hardware, you wouldn't be happy about that, but you'd sure be happy to write code that uses it. Saves you lots of time. But an observation is because of this implementation technique, as far as what the machine's doing, these complex instructions often weren't actually that much faster than if you wrote out the code in simpler instructions to do the same thing. Because what the machine was really doing were the same simpler micro instructions. And you maybe saved a little bit of time because you didn't have to move as much instructions from memory, but it was basically the same speed. They were often not faster, and sometimes, in fact, the microcode implementation was slower than if you wrote it in terms of simpler instructions yourself. And they were also hard to implement. It's a lot of work for a hardware designer to both implement that instruction and also make sure that it works in all the cases. And, you know, do bug fixes if they need to, which bug fixing in hardware is not very pleasant. So, you know, a lot of extra verification work when you're shipping your mini computer. And the other big change is, as I mentioned, at the time of the VAX, people were writing assembly by hand. But it was around the time, you know, shortly after these computers were popular, that people were starting to use compilers commonly and expecting that most of their code might be implemented by compilers. And some academics looking at this said, well, if everyone's using compilers, why do we have these complicated instructions? They're just making it harder for us to design efficient hardware. because it takes just more time to build a new processor, and it's not actually getting any of us speed, and it's not really getting any of us convenience if the compiler could do that anyways. And so this led to the proliferation of RISC ISAs. And these are sort of typical properties that are reaction to that complexity of acts that you'd see in a RISC ISA. So the biggest one is that you're going to have fewer instructions. You're going to keep it down to a core of instructions that you know you can implement efficiently in the hardware that are going to expose the capabilities of your hardware well. Another common attribute is that accessing memory is complicated. Typically, we'll have extra instructions to do that rather than requiring every instruction to implement the functionality to access memory. So in a RISC ISA, most commonly, if you want to access memory, you can't do it with the add instruction at all. You need a different special memory access instruction to either load or store a value from memory. And then you add only on registers. They typically have fixed length instructions to keep the hardware simpler, because reading the machine code for fixed length instructions is going to be much simpler in hardware, as we'll discover when we deal with not fixed length. And they typically, to compensate for having less sort of logic in the processor, have more registers. So an observation is, well, we're saving all this space by not implementing circuits for all these extra instructions. One thing we can do with all that space is just put more registers in there. It's a simple from a hardware design perspective, and up to a point, it's going to help us produce faster code, because we'll have more places to put values that aren't in memory. And they typically will have simpler instructions. So in particular, they'll almost never have instructions that do essentially a loop. Pretty much never. And they'll pretty much never have instructions that take two values from memory. Like x86, I mentioned, has one which does that. And they also typically have few addressing modes. So they're going to say, we're going to have one way of writing addresses. That's all, you know, one or two. That's all you really need. We're not going to implement a whole bunch. That's going to make our hardware more complex, and it's not actually that helpful for the compiler, we think. So these are typical attributes. It's kind of a fuzzy line. And you'll see sort of mixes of this all over the place. There's very few ISAs which are definitely, this is definitely, definitely a RISC ISA. Like MIPS one at least, is one, but you know, usually it's kind of in between. So in this course, we're going to be using, I mentioned Y86. And Y86 you can think of as kind of a somewhat reduced version of x86. And it follows many of those sorts of design philosophies of RISC ISAs that simplify things, but not all of them. So one thing it does is it omits most of the instructions. We certainly have fewer instructions. So here is the list of instructions you have that are kept from x86. Note that we don't have a list of like 1,000 of them. This only takes one slide, which I'm sure you appreciate. We also make some changes. So one thing is we have this move queue I mentioned is renamed. And this renaming is going to partly be doing one of those things I mentioned that RISC does, of having separate instructions for accessing memory versus not. So our move queue instruction, we're going to split into several instructions with this naming convention. We have a letter for the source, a letter for the destination, and then move queue. And we're going to split this into several instructions, which are going to operate on either immediates, meaning a value in the instruction, a constant, register, or memory. And we have all these possibilities of things we could have, move instructions we could have. We're not going to have any of the ones which move to an immediate, because that doesn't make any sense. Can't change a constant. And we're going to happen to omit the memory-to-memory move, because that would be complicated, as we said. So we're not going to have it. If you want to do that, you have to use a register and two instructions. And we're just not going to implement the immediate-to-memory move, even though we probably could, which is not very useful for real programs. If you have a constant value you want in memory, you probably just put it in your executable as a constant that gets loaded when your executable gets loaded, so it's not actually a very useful instruction to provide. Yes? The question is, what is an immediate? An immediate is a constant value that appears in an instruction. So like when we add a constant in an instruction, that constant is an immediate. It's so-called an immediate because it appears immediately in the instruction. We don't need to go anywhere to get it. So these are all the variants of move we have. So you have a constant into a register to a register, and memory to a register, and a register to memory. So, and there's the two possibilities we didn't implement. So there's one instruction on here which doesn't get renamed, which you probably don't recognize. So C move, and I have CCs in italics. You might infer from JCC that I mean something about a condition. And this is conditional move. So these are instructions that exist in XV6, but you probably didn't use them in XV6. In YD664, they're register to register only. In real XV6, just like other moves, they can access memory. And basically the idea is that this replaces a short jump. That instead of conditionally jumping over a move, that you can use this one instruction to move if the condition codes say a certain thing. So C move G is if the condition codes say the last comparison or result is greater than, then move from RAX to RBX, that whatever value was in RAX. And this exists for all the variations of conditional jump we have. We'll have a conditional move instruction. So any questions on how this works? Yeah. Yes, yeah, so you can do, this is C move G, so for conditional move greater, we also have conditional move less than equal, and so on. We won't implement actually all the suffixes real XV6 does, but we'll do all the sign comparison ones. Yeah. So the question is the YAD6 syntax going to be based on AT&T? Yes. And that's why these are both YAD6 examples, because there's no RR move Q instruction in XV6. So another instruction you might see here that I've listed as rename is this HLT instruction, which you almost certainly haven't used before. So this is an instruction that exists in XV664. And the YD664 instruction is called halt because we didn't run out of vowels. And it stops the processor. So if you didn't stop the processor, what's going to happen? There's something in memory after that last instruction. The processor is going to read the machine code there and do something. So we need this instruction to actually stop the processor. And on real XV6, this is something the OS would do, and you're not allowed to do it yourself. But the OS is allowed to run this instruction that stops the processor. So one thing is we saw that we had these various move instructions, and I had separate move instructions for memory and registers. And part of this is going to be because of how we specify values for memory. So first, here's a register to memory move from R11 to 10 plus R12. So this is valid, but we're not going to support all those other addressing modes. So one of the risk things was to keep the hardware simpler, support less addressing modes. That's what we're going to do. We're only going to support single register and offset. All the other ones we aren't going to implement. When you write YAD6 assembly, you have to live without them. So another big thing is that in x86, you access memory in every instruction. So you can add a value from memory to a register just directly. In y86, we're not going to allow this. So I mentioned that risk. We like having separate instructions to read to access memory in general than our normal instructions, and this is something we're going to do in Y86. So that RM move Q and MR move Q are the only instructions besides push and pop, which we're going to have to access memory. So instead, we're going to have to do an explicit move as a set move from memory or to memory as separate instructions. This is going to make implementing the hardware easier because now you only have to worry about one kind of instruction accessing memory, and that's the only thing the instruction does. You don't have to worry about doing something after you access memory with the value you've got. So this is going to make implementing our hardware easier, even though it might be substantially less convenient if you're writing assembly by hand. And that's what I have for today. To keep things synced with the other class, I'm a little early. Okay. So remember, lab this week, finish the homework.